From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Kurdish fighters in Syria liberated a key town in the northern province of Aleppo near the Turkish border. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
Kurdish forces retook the town of Tel Rafat between Aleppo City and the city of Azaz near the Turkish border. The new gain comes despite heavy shelling of the positions of Kurdish fighters in northern Syria by the Turkish military for 3 days in a row. Ankara says it regards the Kurdish group known as the YPG as an offshoot of the banned Kurdistan Workers Party, or the PKK. Earlier on Monday, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu said Ankara will not let the Syrian Kurds take over the Azaz border crossing between the two countries. Damascus says Ankara is considering a military intervention.
There were reports over the weekend that Turkish shells targeted Syrian government forces directly for the first time in 5 years of fighting. The UN Secretary General's office said that close to 50 people were killed in attacks in northern Syria as Syria's army engaged insurgents in fierce battles across the Aleppo and Idlib provinces. That report came as the UN's special envoy on Syria, Stefan de Mistura, arrived in Damascus for talks Tuesday with Syria's foreign minister, Walid Mualem. Meanwhile, Turkey accused Russia of perpetrating a war crime on its border. This was Turkey's Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu Monday.
Russia has launched ballistic missiles from the Caspian Sea into the town of Azaz. They hit a school and a hospital, killing many civilians.
But RT's William Whiteman said that Davutoglu's claim that Russia was responsible is dead wrong and that the evidence points to Turkey as the culprit.
I'm assuming here that Davutoglu meant to say a cruise missile instead of ballistic missile, because a ballistic missile, when it's fired, it goes up into the atmosphere and then descends back down to Earth. To date in the Syrian conflict, Russia has only deployed cruise missiles, which when they're launched, they fly along a straight path, sort of like an aircraft does. Most importantly, when they are fired, they have to have airspace cleared in the countries they fly across. In this case, that would be Iran and then possibly Iraq. Both of those governments have said that neither of them have reported having to clear airspace so a cruise missile can fly across. As well, another thing that's very important to take into consideration is that America has tracked every single one of Russia's cruise missiles, which it has launched to date, and they too have not spoken out either. Obviously, the Russian Defense Ministry has also said that no cruise missiles were deployed to date. If you take all this into account, it does seem highly unlikely that this was indeed a cruise missile or even a ballistic missile attack, as the Turkish Prime Minister claimed. Turkey has been attacking Kurdish forces who are operating in the area since Saturday. The Turkish Foreign Ministry said earlier that if the Kurds approach Azaz, then they'll meet the harshest of reactions from the Turkish state military. He said that they will not allow Azaz to fall to the Kurds. Let's not forget the fact that Turkey is carrying out military action on Syrian territory here, and without the invitation of the Syrian state. So that does violate international law. And we also know from Doctors Without Borders that multiple hospitals affiliated with it have come under fire, have been attacked in the recent weeks. Doctors Without Borders report. And this is because of they are being caught in a crossfire between Kurdish forces and Syrian rebels operating within the area.
From neighboring Aleppo province, attacks on one of the last jihadist strongholds near the Turkish border in the town of Azaz killed at least 14 when missiles hit a children's hospital and a school sheltering refugees. That according to a report from Reuters. The strikes in Azaz came as Turkey continued its shelling of Kurdish YPG positions for the third day running, about 5 miles from the border. At UN headquarters in New York Monday, the so-called Responsibility to Protect Doctrine, or R2P, appeared to be moving back onto center stage after its last invocation, that being in the case of Libya, resulted in the destruction of that country by an 8-month-long U.S.-led NATO bombing campaign and its overrunning by foreign jihadist forces. Nevertheless, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, addressing members of the Security Council Monday during an open debate on the UN Charter, said the UN is ready to help countries uphold their fundamental responsibility to protect. Jocelyn Sambira, has more.
Human rights abuses are, in effect, early warning signs of the instability that often escalates into atrocity crimes, the Secretary General has underscored. In some situations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon says, countries may lack the capacity to fulfill their obligations to deal with abusers. But in others, he adds, it's the member states themselves who are the main violators of human rights.
I know that at times, member states feel that such efforts are a form of interference that undermines national sovereignty. But it is a violence and conflict, and not our attempt to help member states prevent it, that threaten to state sovereignty. It is a violation of human rights by the state that erode the legitimacy of the state. In this engagement, the United Nations seeks to reinforce a sovereignty, not challenge or undermine it.
Mr. Ban added that the unity of the Security Council was a crucial factor in overseeing the peaceful resolution of disputes before they got worse. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
Venezuela holds the presidency of the Security Council this month, and the country's foreign minister, Delcy Rodriguez, spoke at a media stakeout Monday on the need to respect the principles and purposes of the UN Charter as a basis for maintaining international peace and security.
Some countries try to pretend that they are play the police of the world, and this has led us to face different challenges at multilateral sphere. And it is important to regulate the violent powers that it aim to destroy the countries, and by means of dialogue and diplomacy. The political dialogue is important, the diplomacy is important as well, always following the Article 33 of the Charter of the United Nations, to defend the purposes of the Charter, and trying not to vulnerate and to the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the state.
As the country faces another year of endless war abroad and poverty and austerity at home, the 2016 U.S. presidential election continues to resemble a cross between professional wrestling and a barroom brawl, with the latest making the rounds on social media being a tweet from reality TV candidate Donald Trump that reads, quote, Jeb forgot to renew the rights to his domain name for his website. Guess who bought the website? JebBush.com, closed quote. In our ongoing look at the spectacle that is the American electoral system, we spoke with Jared Ball, author, radio host, and associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University, via Skype Friday. What do you think is going to come out of this presidential election? We have so many needs and so many problems. Do you see any of them being addressed or, God help us, solved at the end of the day?
Well, unfortunately, I don't see any solutions coming. At best, I guess on the optimistic end, there are those, and I struggle with this a lot, and I'd like to hear your thoughts as well. But, optimistically, there are those who would say, well, Sanders' presence in this alone is a positive. Win or lose, he is going to advance the conversation and already has in this country, just being able to bring up socialism or single-payer health care or challenges to banks, and he's going to break up the banks, and he wants to improve employment and his overtures to Black Lives Matter, et cetera. But pessimistically, and honestly, that's where I tend to be on this, is that I think that much like many of these campaigns in the past, this will be where progressive endeavors, progressive ideals, or truly radical potential within the electorate and within the country will be sort of safely channeled back to the Democratic Party. Where I do see some pushback on that, and I hope it's increased and it's honest, is where some, at least, unlike what I think we heard back in 08 with Obama, some who a significant some at least seem to be saying if they don't get a Sanders victory, that they will not support the Democratic Party, they will not support Hillary, and move on to something, to the alternative. To the extent that's true, that's great, but the reality of that, I'm not so sure. So I'm very skeptical of this. I'm skeptical of Sanders as a radical figure, and I'm skeptical of these popular, almost too easily arrived at popularity that he's attaining and support that he's getting. without, I think, the requisite movement that we need to make these electoral campaigns really mean anything. But I will also say just very quickly that although I admittedly want to support an alternative political electoral option, Green Party, Party for Socialism and Liberation, here in Maryland, the Ujima People's Progressive Party, a black worker-led party, those are the kinds of things that are more honestly exciting to me. But what we see in terms of the Sanders-Clinton divide and debate within the Democratic Party, within the establishment of the so-called civil rights leadership in the Democratic Party, is these ridiculous statements and overtures, particularly from John Lewis, that he didn't see Bernie when he was marching and doing his civil rights work, but he somehow did come across Bill and Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's just pure absurdity. Especially given the Clintons' track record against the interests of black people and working people specifically over the many decades. But what we're really seeing is this tension between the old guard, so to speak, trying to pay back debts or remain what they think is politically relevant or viable. I think in the case of Sharpton and people like Michael Eric Dyson, there's this concern that once Hillary gets elected, which is what I think they expect to happen, that their place in the punditry will be lost, and they don't want to lose that notoriety or certainly those paychecks. So that's where I think we see what we see happening there. But again, following them is something I would have argued a long time ago and have been for a long time is fool's gold as well. So I see in them the sort of civil rights equivalent to what I see happening with Bernie Sanders and the Democratic Party.
You know, a lot of folks on the left particularly, but even in the general narrative, talk about Sanders, making it okay to use the S word again, socialism. But I'm wondering if that's not a two-edged sword, because first of all, he himself, if you look at a textbook, let alone a socialist's definition of socialism, has actually denied the fact of his being a socialist by saying he's not in favor of the workers appropriating the means of production. Does his use of the word socialism with a redefinition of it essentially be, taking what I guess would be social democratic policies and branding them socialism, does it advance the cause or does it cheapen it?
Well, I'm very glad actually that you asked that question. I happen to think it cheapens it. Now, obviously there is some debate around that, and within what I see, I can't say I'm in these camps, but from what I see out from an outside perspective within the socialist community, there's at least some sort of, if not a vigorous debate going on about that. But I think it cheapens it much in the same way I think that no disrespect to her individually or personally, that I think that the assigning of black revolutionary symbolism to Beyonce has been happening since the Super Bowl in some cases, is damaging to what that symbolism and those politics are or should represent. So I don't see personally, and this was another one of my pessimistic concerns around Sanders, that if he is the definition writ large or in terms of a sort of a macro grand perspective of socialism, then what is a real socialist? Then what is real socialism? And I don't follow the logic that others lay down that this will be a stepping stone to getting there. And in fact, I use what I see happening with him in the healthcare debate as an example. I mean, for many of us, there were those of us who were saying years ago that the Affordable Health Care Act under Obama was not, as his supporters were saying, a stepping stone to full national single-payer health care, that it would in fact be used to block further steps being taken on that issue. And we see it happening now already, that Bernie Sanders, who is now trying to, or at least claiming to want to advocate a single-payer health care plan, has to fight against, as he keeps trying to remind us, the plan he helped write and institute with Obama. So that is that these claims that we're going to get a stepping stone to something progressive is, I think, more of a stepping stone or a stone being used to build a greater wall between where we are and where we want to get.
Yeah, so, you actually saw that like manifest really in a discussion between Clinton and Sanders. When Sanders raised single payer, Clinton actually was saying, "You're jeopardizing Obamacare by raising it."
Right. No, I mean, that's been going on through all these debates, and that's why I was like, this is again the perfect example of that. So it's the same thing I feel with this idea of socialism, especially seeing really what I'm mostly critical of in all of these instances is the process that's producing whatever it is we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it was the same way that I know many of us felt, not enough of us, obviously, in 2008 with Obama, that just looking at the process before you even get to the man as an individual or the woman as an individual or even their individually claimed policies, there's a process that I think that needs to be respected and understood as how they got there in the first place. And because none of these people are the genuine result of a movement that put them there, they were not evolved from the true grassroots upward with a clear mandate of the people. They are top-down imposed elite politicians who are now claiming a certain radicalism. Obama obviously claimed a certain radicalism he didn't ascribe to once elected. And Bernie is ascribing to a certain politics or claiming a certain politics that he hasn't really demonstrated as an independent or throughout his political career, but is doing it through a process and in institutions that I don't think can produce the change he's claiming he wants. So in that regard, I agree with what Clinton is saying when she and others look at him and say, what you're proposing is insane given what we had to do just to get where we are. And one of the reasons why it was so hard to even get where we are is because what is ultimately for me the biggest issue is that we on the so-called left have not been strong enough, organized enough, and committed enough to the radical politics we claim to make all of those that get elected to power genuinely have to adhere to those left, really, truly progressive politics.
You know, on the same track as the use of the word socialism here, internationally, we saw the phenomenon in Greece, for example, when the radical left got elected, Syriza, the finance minister who became a rock star, Yanis Varoufakis, goes out and has in the audience to demonstrate his credentials, John Kenneth Galbraith's son. I mean, is that radical left economics to go back to liberalism, basically?
Well, far from being an expert in that situation, but it did, I guess, simplistically look a lot as you described to me, as, you know, again, being an outsider to that situation. But that's again the point that ultimately what we're going to be asked in this election is what I think was being said there in Greece, that we're doing the best we can given where we are. And yet people in Greece, and I think a lot of people here with Obama, and I think more so would be the case with Sanders, should he actually get elected, would be saying, well, but we voted for you based on a desire for so much more. So the standard shouldn't be the fear of a right wing, or the standard shouldn't be the horrors of where we have been dragged so far to the right. The standard should be what we actually want as a society. And if that's otherwise, I don't see how we're actually going to make any real progress, because everything that's been called progress in this country is based on the worst of conditions for black people, primarily enslavement, and for the rest, some pre-labor movement, workers' era, full-on exploitation of working people in this country, again, an inappropriate standard. So, and yet we still see what we see now with the gaps between rich and poor widening, the gaps between white and black widening in terms of material inequality, and so on and so on and so on. Things keep getting worse and worse and worse, or certainly don't progress at a rate that most of us think is necessary. So I just don't see, I don't want to be told, well, we have to do the best we can given that the possibilities of a Trump election or the possibilities that something else will happen. I think we need to start to develop movements and parties and efforts that will make, again, these elections meaningful, and that will make the ability for politicians that are elected to live up to their promises possible.
And one other thing on that point too, socialists, the way I understood it growing up, the idea of socialism rests first of all on a class identity of a working class, and also on the concept of that class being international or transnational. The United States is the premier imperial power, you know, in the history of the world at this point. And its marauding around the country brings back all of this wealth, around the world rather, brings back all of this wealth to the United States. And what visions we're seeing between, say, Clinton and Sanders, or the Republicans and Sanders, or whatever, is really how to divvy it up and not some sort of class solidarity with the people around the world that are being exploited by the same people exploiting workers here.
Well, first of all, I mean, absolutely. That you know, I've, in terms of the black context, I've often made the point that, extending Malcolm X's analogy, that we are the world's house slaves, given that we have it relatively better than most of the African population in the world just because we're here. And I would say the same largely for any other community in this country, that we are in the seat of empire, so it's going to look a little better here. And look how bad yet it still is in terms of the inequality and the access to resources, et cetera. And this is where, again, the Democratic Party cannot be helpful. When she was Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton said explicitly that she was using her position to increase the business strength of American corporations, cutting deals for Lockheed Martin and Boeing and other military defense contractors, using her relationships to make that a possibility. Bernie, of course, his most glaring foreign policy problem, for particularly for those on the real left, is his support of Israel. So where then will this international solidarity movement go through this faux socialism of Bernie Sanders, if that's why people are saying that they want to vote for him? So, and yet again, I think to your point also, certainly to mine, is that the definitions for these terms are going to be dragged too far to the left. So the concepts of revolutionary socialism will seem anathema to those who find Bernie's version, perfectly suitable. And I think it would be a great blow to, which is what I do believe, maybe you can help me with this as well. Bernie is still struggling, not that they're doing this necessarily for progressive reasons, but Bernie is still struggling to get the support of labor unions. I know Trump, I believe, said he wants to support Hillary. Not that that's an improvement, but at this point that the labor union movement is some radical left movement. But I think that in terms of if working people here or unions here are to be strengthened, even a candidate for the Democratic Party is going to make that more difficult because their foreign policy and the policies that they support and have supported, particularly in terms of Hillary and her husband, will destroy any potential radical unity for working people, and give a bad name to, I think, socialism and anything that can be called progressive. So, again, I really just want people who want to vote for Bernie for what it is that he says he wants to enact through his policy, I really want them all to consider, and all of us more to consider, how the apparatus he is working through and the party he's working with and the absence of a movement that would push him and Congress, once, if he was to be elected, to do these things, doesn't exist, and that we could all then, I think, be better suited to build that movement instead of telling people on the actual left, no, you guys can't win, and we got to give, you know, this is the best shot we have using electoral politics is to support Bernie, despite all of these contradictions and flaws in his mostly dealing with his foreign policy. And if people who are already prone to that would make that final leap and say, well, let's actually build an alternative, I think we would be far better off. Other than that, I think, you know, these campaigns, as Glenn Ford and others at Black Agenda have been saying for a while, are where the Democratic Party is where progressive or radical politics goes to die.
Yeah. I've heard it referred to as what's the thing that bugs go in but they don't come out? Roach Motel.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay, so Sanders is elected, and people are calling him a socialist. We had Barack Obama, who was elected, the first black president, not even like African-Americans, quote-unquote, you know, 8, 10 generations in the United States. First generation, his father born in Kenya, and he brings AFRICOM with Hillary Clinton, the friend of black folks, brings AFRICOM to Africa and, of course, destroys Libya, which was planning to bankroll the United States of Africa. What would a socialist president do to socialism around the world?
I mean, I think I don't even know what the equivalent would be, but it in terms of image, it would certainly, certainly it would be the same thing. I mean, in the sense that I don't know the exact mechanism to, you know, relative to AFRICOM that would be used per se. I don't, my crystal ball isn't that clear, but I think that it would be hard. I mean, again, if you just look at what Bernie Sanders is saying about his foreign policy, there's really little different that he wants, that he's pushing for, little radically different, at least. And he keeps praising Obama as a president, and what he has done. But I certainly haven't heard him condemning AFRICOM or condemning U.S. foreign policy throughout the continent of Africa. I certainly haven't, seen him, quite the opposite, condemn or even critique the drone warfare that's mostly taking place on the continent and what is often called the Middle East. So, I mean, you know, if the first black president, who many were he himself, you know, helped along with this mythology, we're calling him the extension of the civil rights and black power movements. If that's what those movements were to get us to, and a movement for socialism in this country was all that, you know, is what would produce a Bernie Sanders, then all of these movements and histories and labels and definitions, mean very little, or are at least confused. But again, that's really my point. Socialists, I think, I don't think they need me to say this, or anyone needs me to say this, to tell them this, but it's, you know, it does need to be reminded that it wasn't a socialist movement that produced Bernie Sanders. It's not like it was even the capitulation of a conservative wing of the socialist movement that won through some sort of series of debates or platforms or movements or elections that produced Bernie Sanders. It was his very allegiance to the Democratic Party that kept him as an independent in Vermont, and then allowed him, as he continues to remind us, to caucus always with the Democratic Party, and then to enter their party officially to run for their nomination for the presidency. So he is, again, much like Obama was. But Obama was not the product of an ongoing civil rights black power movement. It was, he was handed to us or imposed on us by a top-down liberal wing of the ruling elite conversation and process that brought him to us. And then we all ascribe hopes and values to him that he didn't really embody or come up through. And I think the same thing is happening here with Bernie Sanders. The so-called left, much of the so-called left that's supporting him, they're not even coming out of socialist politics tradition. They're coming out of, at best, liberal sort of Democratic Party politics, and seeing him as the new savior, the one for a new generation to get excited around. But it's not that they've produced him as the product of a movement, and I think that's the biggest problem with all of this, that all of these symbols and definitions and candidates are being imposed on us from the top down, and it's doing damage to everything that they say that they represent.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.